I could park it up near the bins.
I was going to say, didn't this ruin you financially?
I lost thousands in depreciation. Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Classics World Chat Show, where we get to talk all things classic cars and what we've been up to in the last week or so. I'm joined by the editor of Classic Car Buyer, Jeff Ruggles, and of course, Joe Miller. So chaps, let's crack on. First of all, with our what's in the news this week, the Classic Car Buyer 13th of May issue has just gone to the printers and will be out next Wednesday.
Is it the 13th of May by any chance?
Yes, exactly. On the 13th of May, funny enough. It's funny. Creative name titles and everything. But Jeff, as you're the man that puts all that news pages together, you can tell us the main headline topic was, I believe, something that came out of the HCVA day at Brooklands a couple of weeks ago.
It was, but I'm going to spoil your intro because I've been on a, obviously I was away for the previous podcast, and I just wanted to quickly mention the 21st anniversary of Driver Day and how successful that was. Obviously, the FBHVC, they sell rally plates to raise money for Childline, and they were up by 20% this year, so I thought that was really good. And even just sort of tooling around the local area, I saw loads of cars out enjoying what was a really sunny day, actually, so that was really nice. It's sort of TVRs, a local coffee meet, more than 60 events all over the country, so I thought that was worth mentioning. So far, they've raised over the last 5 years £250,000 for Childline. And with the success of this year's rally plates, we haven't got any figures yet, but it's looking really good for boosting that total. So that's really positive. And as you mentioned, Phil, in this week's issue, we're looking back to the HCVA Trade Day, the Heritage Matters Day. And it was quite interesting what came out of it about the sort of changing profile of the classic car buyer these days. Kind of moving away from the oily rag tinkerer that we all kind of like to be, our sort of Morris Minor, to sort of high-end dealerships now offering a really curated experience where they not only supply the car, it's not just a transaction anymore. They'll get you tickets for Goodwood, or they'll sort you out a concourse entry or something like that. Because some of the more affluent buyers entering the scene probably are a little bit, you know, they're working hard, they're time poor, and so they can now have this more wider experience that sort of dealers are now happy to facilitate for them, which is really nice. And another thing that came out of that was it's not just dad anymore, it's the whole family. And another string to it is how they expect more reliability from these cars. So the likes of S&G Barrett and firms who are able to 3D print parts or use modern technology to take an old part, take away the flaws and make it work. Now that's really important.
We probably do still get obsessed with the idea that we all buy old bangers and then spend ages in the garage sort of fettling.
Well, I do that still. And I think many people will still do that.
Well, there'll always be a contingent of people that do that and do that very much as part of the hobby and the enjoyment of the hobby. But like you say, there's probably a wealth of people who just want to be out there and enjoying those cars, whether it's in their own car or with someone else or just going to a car show to witness other people enjoying their cars.
Yeah.
So I think at least, it's good to accept that that makes the scene much bigger and richer for it, I would suggest.
Yeah, I think it leads to a question of sort of where cars, you know, like resto mods are going to sit, because these are cars obviously have the old aesthetics, but modern technology underneath them to make them more usable. And sometimes, you know, some people are a bit negative about them. So you can point to the purists maybe, and sometimes I include myself in that. So it'd be interesting to see how those cars are valued in the future or how many more are going to be made. There's actually a new story, and this will make you feel really old. It certainly makes me feel old. And there's a new story in the current issue just going to press about an Audi TT resto mod.
What?
Wow. Yes, which replicates the concept car from 95. Yes, that was 31 years ago.
My Lord.
I was talking to the editor of Volksworld magazine the other day, and we were talking about how the air-cooled enthusiast uses their vehicle now. Typically, they will still go to a lot of car shows, but they might actually trailer the car there, you know, particularly if it's a long way away. Now, trailer queens have often perhaps been judged unfairly because they're not really using their cars. But to put it in context, I think some of these guys are using their cars for local meets, coffee mornings and things like that within a 20, 30 mile radius of where they live or where their car is stored. But they might then take the car on a trailer to a show further afield just to, you know, indulge in the passion for their car. So I think even that, our take on that probably needs to be revisited, because it does it make them any less of an enthusiast if they're not doing hundreds of miles driving it under its own steam?
I think anyone who puts an old car
and uses it rather than make it a museum piece, whether that means they restore it, they drive it, they show it, they track it, whatever they do. If you're investing your time and your money into something that isn't a modern electric SUV, then you're winning anyway. Even if you do 1,000 miles a year in an old car, if that's 1,000 miles not done in a Tesla or a BYD, then again, you're ahead.
Well, we're barely 5 minutes into the podcast, Joe, and you've already managed to get in 2 slides about SUVs and electric vehicles. So well done.
As you know, because most of my time off goes on it, I love a road trip, especially a continental one.
Yes,
but
indeed.
I think if you've got a car in a concourse and it's supposed to be the best example of that car as a kind of reference point to how perfect or, you know, how good that particular car can be, you know, the best of the best. I personally couldn't give a monkey's if you've taken it there on a trailer, because I want to see that perfect car. I want to see that aspirational top of the tree car. Don't care if you drove it there or not. Obviously, I respect the people that do drive them and then clean them when they get there. And I think that is most people, because they simply, you know, you spend so much money on the car, you probably can't spend it out on a box trailer. But if you're truly to see the best of the best, I genuinely don't care how it got there. That might be controversial, but that's my view.
No, I think that's very open-minded. Well, I tell you what, we've got listeners and viewers. Why don't we reach... Go on then. Those of you listening and watching, comment now. What's your take on it? Trailer queen, if it's absolutely mint, or would you drive it there? Let us know.
Yes. No, indeed. That would be very good to hear your views. But I guess what we can take from that HCVA day is that an appreciation that classic car ownership is still booming, but also expanding and diversifying in terms of the type of owner and enthusiast that we've got in the scene now. And that should only be encouraged, I would suggest.
Yeah, it's all evolving, isn't it? And that keeps everything fresh, whether you agree with it or not. Change is never necessarily
Absolutely.
A bad thing.
Right, chaps, I want to move on to our buying segment, which it's 50 years of the VW Golf Mark 1 GTI this year.
Yeah.
Yes.
And rightly or wrongly, and someone will tell us otherwise, but it's probably attributed as the sort of first hot hatch, or the hot hatch as we know it. And other people will come up with other suggestions as to what that pioneering hot hatch was. But the Mark 1 Golf GTI is probably acknowledged as the sort of...
Certainly the first successful one.
Yeah, yes. I think it's the trigger for how it became mainstream, isn't it?
But rightly or wrongly, the hot hatch was also attributed to killing off the traditional sports roadster, the MGBs and the like of this world. So I kind of wanted us to come up with a hot hatch of our choice and a sporting roadster of our choice. So you can have one of each, but I've also given us, because I can never do just one, I've given us the latitude to also choose an alternative. And that could be a wild card or just be another one that ran a close second to your first choice. So pick a favourite hot hatch and a favourite sporting roadster.
Well, also you hamstrung us slightly at the last minute by saying that you had to get both these cars for under £30,000, which in the ever-booming hot hatch market is not easy.
I think I'm comfortably in, to be honest.
Yeah, well, exactly. Actually, I struggled to hit 30 grand in the end with my choice.
Yeah, no, I did.
I would say is that, yes, 30 grand probably means that you can't be shopping around in E-type money and things like that for...
You're just sort of discounting that drop-top Ferrari that I...
Well, there we go. Maybe that's another podcast, Jeff. But go on then, Jeff, you start with your choices. What's your hot hatch choice, please?
Well, I believe Joe has a choice that's very close to my heart, but I'm gonna sideswipe that one and bring in a good old Austin Rover favourite, the MG Maestro Turbo.
Ooh, bonus points for it being the Turbo.
Great choice.
Yeah, well, it's kind of always been a bit of a hero car for me because the Maestro 1.6, the MG, the 1.6 variant, was a little bit plagued, a little bit troublesome. And when they brought the 2-litre EFI version out in 1984, it basically transformed the car. It made it a really credible hot hatch, as good as, a little bit quicker perhaps than an 8-valve Golf GTI at the time. And I drove one when I first joined a classic car buyout. It was a really nice car. It just drove really well. And my dad had one when we were growing up, a 2-litre I as well, E-Ridge one. And I just always quite liked them. But of course, I sort of nagged him at the time. We need a turbo. 0-60 in 6.7 seconds. Now that's impressive now.
That's quick. Yeah.
But when it came out in 1988, you know, that bold body kit, which is a little bit ugly if we're honest, but I like it. The big turbo script down the side. They only built 505 of them. And I've just always really wanted one. And they even have a single SU carb. But I don't know. It's just all this combination that just makes me, you know, I'd like to own one. They're quite a lot of money now. You probably need at least 12 grand, I'd say, to buy a good one, because a lot of rotten away. But yeah, that would be my.
I think it's a fabulous choice. My uncle actually ditched a Mark III Capri 2.8 injection for an MG Maestro Turbo. So there's two decent cars that I would happily have in my dream garage. So that's a good choice. Yeah, and is there a wild card or an alternative hot hatch that you'd have instead of the MG Maestro Turbo?
There's a bit of thought that's gone into this. First thoughts were an Alfa Romeo 147 GTA because of just how unhinged it is. But I suppose you could say that my choice is a bit of a wild card because it's not actually that quick. And I would really like a Series 1 Peugeot 106 Rally. Only a 1.3 engine, 100 horsepower, homologation special, all stripped out, white steel wheels, you know, motorsport stripes, just not really the kind of super practical car like a Mark II Golf GTI would be, but more of a sort of fizzy, high revving, hot cam, close ratio gearbox.
They are cool though, and they probably feel faster than they really are.
Well, I think that's it. This is an entertaining car that you could probably have some real fun in without risk of losing your license like you would in a sort of modern hyper hatch. If I could find a nice white one on the white steels, or even a Series 2, you know, the 1.6 Series 2 is rare actually and very cool as well, but I think I'd have to have a Series 1 if it was, you know, if there was a choice.
I think that's an inspired choice. So, Joe, go on and give us your hot hatch choices.
Hot hatch choices. My default choice was the one that you got to first, so I won't spoil it, but I'll let you have that when you get to it, Phil. My second choice was 205 GTI. However, if I went for that, this would be yet another podcast where I talk about the Peugeot 205 GTI.
Well, so welcome to the 205 GTI podcast.
Yes, indeed. So I'm not going to talk about that either. Now, my third choice was in along those lines. You think 205 GTI, but think just a tiny bit more refined, a few years newer, but still raw, still raucous, still a proper driver's car. The Renault Clio Williams.
They're quite expensive now. Are you going to get that in?
So I shopped around. Yeah. I had a look online. You're not getting a Clio Williams 1, even barely within budget, full stop. You will get a 3. It might not be mint, but you will get one. I saw a few around for around the £15,000 mark. Now, it's a lot of money for what it is, but they're really rare. They look fantastic on the gold speed lines, the little bonnet bulge and the chunky body kit, and the bolstered seats and so on, the blue dials. And they look great. They're fast enough. They're 150 odd horsepower, so they're about as quick as the Maestro. Yeah, just fabulous car. So yeah, absolutely love the Clio Williams.
I quite like the Clio 16 valve, you know, without the smaller engine. But you know, the Williams is top of the tree, isn't it?
It's gold, cool,
gold speed lines, and
yeah,
and probably because of their value, if the Williams's models survived in greater numbers,
reasonably well. Yeah, they're not common by any means, but there's enough of them around. That, put it this way, if you wanted one, you could go online now and find one. You know, they're not that rare yet. You'd have to pay a lot of money.
The 16 valve was rarer.
The 16 valve is rarer, yeah.
And what would a Williams set you back?
You'd start your search around 15 grand for something usable now. And if you wanted a Williams one that was mint, you could easily pay 30 grand for it. But I'm gonna play a technicality and say Williams 3.
Okay, good. All right. And what was your alternative hot hatch choice?
Well, now, so again, I thought hot hatch or raucous, exciting. I defaulted to one of my absolute favorite cars, which is Talbot Sunbeam Lotus, which is technically a hot hatch. They have got a hatchback. And I think that, again, they're fabulous. Go and watch a video on the channel if you haven't. I absolutely love them. Dogleg gearbox. I'd have it over a Mark II Escort any day of the week. But because they are so rare, and then because so many of them have been rallied, and because they're actually quite collectible now, you can get one within budget, but you do have to be clever. Because I went online and found there's one in France, which is left-hand drive, and it's had a few bits done to it, and it's got stripped out interior and so on. But that is €17,000. So you could technically get one within budget, but you would have to be clever about it.
Yeah.
I didn't realize the 30 grand budget was going to be so challenging.
Well, the sort of the last one I saw, I think, was 45 grand.
Yeah, that's in the UK. You're right. A really good one in the UK is that kind of money. So you do have to shop around, and I dare say it will be a waiting game. But if you play it safe and you bide your time, what a car you've got. They're just fabulous.
Well, very good. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for leaving me with the obvious choice, or what I think is the obvious choice, probably. But I went Golf GTI Mark II. Initially, I very confidently wrote down 16 valve GTI.
Yes.
And then actually, I kind of struggled to get one in at a sensible price because I sort of dug around all my usual kind of online spaces and was shocked to sort of 16 valve GTIs that were on the market were kind of north of 20. So I kind of thought I'll settle for an 8 valve.
If I must.
If you get an 8 valve one, the prices fall dramatically. I can't believe how much premium people are willing to pay on the 16 valves now. But good condition 8 valves are still available for south of 10, whereas you'll be lucky to get a 16 valve anywhere near 10. I think the Mark II is the sort of peak evolution of the Golf GTI, because I think it takes the original concept and just modernizes it enough. And probably being a kid of the 80s, the Mark II resonates more strongly with me than the Mark I does. I owned a big bumper 8 valve model and I just thought it was fabulous. You could use it every day for any purpose whatsoever and it would still be a fun car. I'd argue the 8 valve doesn't feel that fast, but
fast still enough.
I think you're right, because that defines the hot hatch, doesn't it? Because it's a hatchback that does everything, but is also a performance car at the same time, a fun car to drive.
Basically, for the record, I did find a 16 valve one for £21,500.
I think looking at the historic auctions recently, I think you've seen them do 25, even 30 plus for really mint original ones.
I was quite surprised to be spending that much money on a Golf, but anyway, certainly a Golf that's fast approaching 40 years old. But hot hatch choice, up until recently, I even still had the brochure for this particular car, and that is the Renault 11 Turbo.
Ooh, niche choice. Very unusual.
That is a rare old car.
I just think they're fabulous. And I did find one for sale, which is it was rare. It was just one. I searched for Renault 11s, and out of about 10 Renault 11s, only one of them was a Turbo model.
What about abroad? I reckon you might
have found it. It was in Portugal. It was in Portugal.
It was in Portugal. Near and handy, man.
So nice and local. But it was 13,500 euros. I think it's a bit of a left field choice, really. Everyone would go for the Renault 5 GT Turbo, right?
But that was kind of the period where Renault were turbo, sort of inspired by their F1 stuff, were turbocharging everything, weren't they?
Yeah.
Twingos, you know, 21s, 19s, everything.
Yeah. No one picked a Japanese hot hatch either.
It was tempting with the EP3 Civic Type R.
I thought about EK9 Type R, the original one. But the reality is, and this is something I've touched on before, anything Japanese, even vaguely performancey, is so expensive now. A good EK9 Type R could swallow up almost all of that budget. They are so expensive.
Okay then, Jeff. So if you weren't going to get the hot hatch, or you wanted the hot hatch and you wanted the Roadster, what's your Roadster?
Controversial choice here, and I'm still not 100% sure if I should say this, but it's a Roadster that's front-wheel drive and drives like a hot hatch. Any guesses?
I know where this is going.
And it's quite rare, and resurrected a legendary name and didn't stay in production for all that long. It's the Lotus Elan M100 Turbo, in my case.
Yes.
A few years back, we drove one for a video, didn't we, up at WB & Sons in Newcastle. And I just sort of marveled at how you could throw it about like a hot hatch.
Yeah.
It was just really usable. And I expected it to be all flimsy and, you know, a bit nasty, but it just wasn't. It felt really well screwed together.
I enjoyed that car as well. I drove that same model and I thought it was excellent. Do you think Lotus would have got away with it if they hadn't called it the Elan?
Maybe, but of course, you know, you just got to point to the MX-5, haven't you, I suppose, which was much more of a truer tribute to the original Elan, because it was so much
cheaper. The Elan being front-wheel drive didn't help either.
Yeah, no, it didn't. And because it was so much cheaper, the MX-5, that really shot the M100 in the foot before it really had a chance to establish itself. Because I think the early orders were really strong. And bosh, along comes the MX-5, and that was that, really. They only made it up to 92. But they're so affordable as well. I mean, I think you could probably buy a decent one for $6,000.
I think that's really great. That's really niche, but I think they're really, really, that's a, I
they
applaud
really
you.
Cool, I think
they're quite underrated.
I remember when we were
filming with it at that time, because obviously you went and did the video and then you said to Phil and I, we both need to go and drive. And both of us came back with that. This is really good. Mm. Really good.
An especially good one, but it was great, wasn't it?
It was great fun. And it made all the right mushy turbo noises. Yeah, I applaud that. It's one of those cars you always forget they exist. And then someone's like, oh, yeah, they're really good.
Yeah, they are. And they're cheap. You know,
I applaud that. Well done. Very good.
What about your alternative, Roast, if you weren't to have an M100?
Another sort of Lotus-based foray, if you like. I quite fancy, and I've always quite fancied, a Vauxhall VX2.
Another good choice.
Cheaper than an Elise, in turbo form, faster than many an Elise. I mean, it's sort of a happy byproduct of Lotus needing the funding to develop the S2 Elise, is that the VX220 arrived. And you could have it with the 2.2 engine or the 2-litre turbo, or the run out, I think VXR, wasn't it? The really quick one was a VXR. That was a very limited run. A Vauxhall badge on a sports car like that, some might turn their noses up. And I think if it shared the name of the Continental version, the Opel Speedster, which sounds a lot cooler, doesn't it?
Yes.
I think more people might like it, but I just really like them. They're a little bit under the radar, just a bit cheaper than an Elise or even an Exige. And yeah, just something a bit different, really.
I think that's the thinking man's choice right there. I think that's very, very, very good. Very good. Come on then, Joe, live vicariously. You can buy a Roadster. What's it going to be?
I'm going to follow in Jeff's footsteps with both his choices. It's British. It's plastic. It may not be the easiest car to own, but it will be fabulous on the days it does. The TVR Chimera.
This comes up quite a lot in your choices. Does, yeah. You need to run a TVR at some point in your life, I think.
I really like Chimeras. They're fabulous. Also, with this kind of budget, assuming I spent about 15 grand on my hot hatch, I'd have about 15 grand for my sports car. And 15 grand gets you a choice of Chimeras. There's a lot on the market for that kind of money or less. They look brilliant. They sound incredible. They're not actually that fast, bizarrely. You'd think they'd be... They almost sound faster than they are, but they're great fun to drive. And as I've touched on in the video, we covered it. They're such a rewarding car to drive. You know, everyone's got in their head that TVRs are these psychopaths that are going to try and kill you. And they're not. It's actually a really docile car that's really rewarding to drive.
Well, yeah, it was designed to be that, wasn't it? It was designed to be a more user-friendly version of the Griffiths. You know, I think it's a great choice.
Very good. Okay, so if you couldn't have your TVR Chimera, what would it be? And don't say TVR Griffith. It's too close.
You wouldn't get one within the budget. No. So again, I had to go a bit niche with this one. So I went a bit older. One of my favorite, again, I thought in the mold of the TVR, British, rear wheel drive, brutish, raw, all the rest of it. I went Triumph TR6.
Nice.
Now, I had to second guess myself because I thought, can you still get a TR6 for that money of about 15 grand anymore? You can, yes. But again, you have to be a bit careful. So you shop around. There are a few imperfect examples on the market. There's a few left-hand drives. There's a few imports. There's a few slightly scruffy ones. But technically, you will get a TR6 for that money. And if you do, you get a fabulous car that looks brilliant, that lovely straight six. They're great fun to drive. And again, they don't beat you up like a big Healey does. They're, again, very rewarding car to drive. And I think they are just wonderful. I'm a big fan of
the car. I'm sure one went through auction not so long ago that went for about 10 or 11.
Yeah.
So they're out. They even had like modern Mazda MX-5 seats in it or something.
Yeah. I've recently seen one go through for six.
Yeah, there you go. So they're out then.
It's that sort of traditional sports car that is just maybe becoming a little bit more accessible to the people who you know, put them on a pedestal and couldn't afford them for a while. And they're just coming into view a little bit more. And I think that's really, really good news, actually. Up their cars are now becoming much more affordable. And that's really good news.
Yeah, no,
that's they're just wonderful things as well. They drive so well.
A good choice.
So go on then, Mr. Wade, which Jaguar are you going to have as your sports car?
So I went quite obvious with my hot hatch choice, and I'm afraid I went a bit obvious with my Roadster choice as well, because I did go with Mazda MX-5. Now, initially, I wrote down the NC version of the Mazda MX-5, but then I thought, actually, I've got a bit of budget to play with, because even if I spend 15 or something, or 20... on my 16-valve Golf, I've still got 10 to 15 to play with. And actually, while Mazda MX-5 NA prices have definitely stiffened over the recent past, I think you can get still quite a nice one for upper single thousands.
Yeah.
If you're willing to go 7, 8, 9 grand, you'll get a really nice NA example. In fact, I saw one on a G-Reg, so that's got to be one of the first in the UK, right? RG, in white with those original slightly smaller alloy wheels and then the Mazda script on the bumper. It looked lovely. I actually quite liked it in white. My second Roadster choice, I think Joe will approve, I went with the Fiat Barchetta.
Ooh.
Okay, yeah.
Yes, we like that.
I always quite like them. I'll be honest, a left-hand drive car always puts me off a bit, but in a car like that, it wouldn't put me off enough. It would be the silly things that would bug me about owning a left-hand drive day-to-day, but with a Barchetta or something of that ilk, it wouldn't matter, would it? Because you're not going in and out of car parks or tow booths. You're just going down a lovely B road on a lovely summer's day. Or you might even go over to mainland Europe where actually having a left-hand drive car is perfect.
Yeah, well, it's only irrespective when you fill it up with petrol and repeatedly try and get in the passenger side.
Yes.
With something like that, where it's a little bit quirky anyway, I think the left-hand drive works with it. I think that's charming.
I love the styling of it. I love the interior of the Barchetta in particular. And I just think it's something a little bit different. And
So what you're telling me is out of all of our Roadsters, all of these traditional, wonderful Roadsters, we've picked two front-wheel drive ones.
Yeah.
Shows there are no rules, right? It's very easy to do it. Basically, I think we've all managed to do it within the 30 grand budget. And in some cases, I was deliberately going quite specky just to get get the car I wanted. But I never would have thought doing this exercise that the cheaper version of the two would have been the Roadster. It's the hot hatch that ends up being my expensive choice, because that 16 valve thing is 20 grand and maybe a bit more. And then you've only got 8 or 9 to spend on the Roadster.
That speaks volumes about the market though, doesn't it? Because the hot hatch boom in the kind of 80s and early 90s, that is what's in at the moment. That's the nostalgia, and that's where the market sits. You know, in 10 years' time, there's a good chance that those cars hopefully will have come back down again in the same way the sports cars were the big money 10 years ago. It's time moves on. It's just nostalgia of the market.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay then, chaps. Well, I'm also keen to know what we've either been up to or what we're about to be up to in or around cars. So, Jeff, why don't you hit us with it?
I've been painting quite a lot of my Mini, to be honest. Finding more rust holes. And sort of totting up how many panels it needs replacing. So there'll be a trip to British Motor Heritage at some point, I think. And of course, I've been getting distracted by other makes and models, because that's what we do, isn't it? So for some strange reason at the moment, I can't really put my finger on it. I really want a Cortina.
Oh, good man.
And I mean, I always liked Cortinas when I was a kid, because I was a strange child and my dad had one. So I thought that, you know, I thought they were kind of cool, even though they probably weren't at the time. It was just a 10-year-old banger.
You know what? We'll do that bit again when we come around to the cars that have caught our eye. So we'll talk about that one in the next segment. But that's all right. That's good. Come back to Cortinas in a minute. That's good. Right, what about you, Joe? What have you been up to in cars?
So, in cars, very little. I sat and worked out the other day. I haven't driven one of my own cars for nearly 2 weeks for various reasons. Obviously, last week, as you listened to this, I was at Alton Park for the opening BSB round, which I won't bore you with it again, but it was fabulous and absolutely brilliant. That's going to be a brilliant year. Well, plans moving ahead, as you listen to this, as it comes out on the Friday, this coming Sunday, we've got big plans, haven't we? Because we're going to be at the South of England Showground in Arding Live for Classic Ford Show, which, me personally, I love Classic Ford Show. It's probably my favourite of the shows we do. It has this really nice kind of Village Fete, Summer Fair type vibe to it, and it's really relaxed. There's no noise and track action. It's just people having a lovely time. And even as someone who's not a huge Ford person, the quality of the cars there and the atmosphere there is lovely. So yeah, very much looking forward to that.
We've got around 900 cars at time of recording on display. So we're really looking forward to a nice mix. And of course, we'll be celebrating 50 years of Fiesta and various other anniversaries, 30 years of the KA or the CA or the car or whatever you pronounce it as.
But about time for a resto mod, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. I think it's been surprising. We have got, I think, 30 KAs lined up.
Brilliant.
Which is cool.
You just have to keep any pigeons away from any sport cars that we have there.
Exactly. And then I think we've got over 50 Fiestas for the 50th.
Amazing.
And we're celebrating 60 years of the Mark II Cortina. Should be a good show. And the weather's looking like it will be more favourable than the forecast was last week when we were recording.
Yeah, it's looking up, isn't it? So yeah, if you're listening, come on down, come and see us, come and see the great unveiling and see what gets revealed. And if you're very lucky, you'll catch us walking around filming as well. So yeah, looking forward to that.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that too. Now, I could just reiterate and say that's where I'm going to be. But I thought I would just share actually a kind of opportunistic moment I had last weekend, because I finally went out in my Rover SD3.
Did you? Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. I wasn't planning on it. My weekends are all kind of daddy taxi duties and boring domesticy stuff. So I don't really get very as often as I'd like to go out. Do you know what? I managed to steal a couple of hours on Saturday, I think it was, and the weather was nice. It was free. So I untethered it from its trickle charger and just jumped in it. It's filthy. It hasn't been washed in forever, but I jumped in it. Starts pretty much first time, and I got out on the road. And actually, it was a little bit rough for the first couple of miles. But once it got up to temperature, and I just was sauntering around the Oxfordshire countryside in it for a good couple of hours, and I really enjoyed it. I wasn't going anywhere. I had nothing in mind. I just tootled around. I had the window down. I wasn't even listening to music. I just ambled along. I had a few people with their thumbs up and waving and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, it's not the best example of a Rover 213 of that vintage, but I just enjoyed, you know, poodling along the country lanes in it. It was a
really
fabulous couple of hours.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed that. That's fabulous. Yeah, we'll get that car back on the channel at some point. Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yes, that was very much a part of me. But anyway, so yes, on to the final segment. Cars that have caught our eye or piqued our interest this week. I think we're all suckers for the classifieds, and we end up looking at cars that we've either seen drive past or at a show, and then it sort of piques that interest that we start looking. That might wonder what would it be like to buy one. So,
Jeff, don't keep us in suspense. What was yours?
You're going to be really surprised by what I say now. I was mindful we were running long, so I was trying to combine segments. Is that a good enough excuse?
That's all right. We can edit it. It's fine.
Yeah, I did. With the classic Ford show, was probably in mind, to be honest. But see, I do like an old Ford. I've got a Mark 1 Fiesta S, which I love. For some reason, I just quite fancy another 70s or 80s Ford. A Cortina would be great, or possibly even a Capri. But I think it's
any particular mark of Cortina?
4 or 5. And I'd like, they're all extinct now, unfortunately, but I'd like a 2-litre S. Because I've got a Fiesta S.
Yeah.
A Cortina S. There was one at the festival in Unexceptional, try saying that quickly, last year in the same colour scheme as what my Fiesta was in. So in the diamond white with the black bumpers and the alloys and the stripy seats.
Oh, that's cool.
That was great. I mean, there must be 5 left, if that. Probably fewer.
But considering how many were sold.
Yeah.
Of all Cortinas, I mean, not just 2-litre S's, but that would be brilliant. No, very good. What about you, Joe?
Well, those of you in the comments that were shocked to hear that Phil didn't pick a Jaguar for our topic last week, I'm going to make amends there because obviously my want of the week last week was an XJS and that's one of my permanent wants of the week. But in more recent times, I travelled up to Morris Lesley in Scotland. You would have seen the auction preview. The auction is not till next Wednesday, so you've still got time. Go and look at Morris Lesley website. One of the cars in that sale I drove was a last generation Jaguar XJ, the X351. Or the swoopy one, if you don't know your Jaguar model names. And it was wonderful. We did it for an upcoming video comparing the first to the last XJ, effectively. And this one was 3-litre diesel. It wasn't even an immaculate example, but it was just wonderful. I think they look gorgeous. The interior is something else. And they are so lovely to drive. It feels like they took everything about the X350 and just take, 10% better. And it's just wonderful. So that is what I would have. I'm not fussy on the engine. I don't care whatever engine it has. I don't care what spec it has. But the fact you can pick up a car like that for 5 or 6 grand and they still look so modern and so brilliant. Yeah, I want a 3-4.
The styling got a bit of a hammering when it first came out. And even the interior got a little bit of barbed comments. But I'm with you. I think not only did it look fabulous then, I think it's aged really well now, like 15, 16 years on.
When you think that car was unveiled in 2008, so that's an 18-year-old car as we sit here today, it could still be brand new. It looks gorgeous. I mean, my personal preference, I would probably, if the budget was unlimited, I'd probably have the supercharged petrol 3-litre, because then you get a good blend of performance and economy without having to have the diesel one, which is a bit blowy uppy, as we always touch on. But honestly, I wouldn't care. I think they're fabulous. And yeah, if I needed to supply myself with a daily driver, I'd seriously look. Not
the X351. The X351's quite personal to me because I had one for our wedding. And in fact, we drove that car all the way down to Tuscany. It was just sublime. It was brilliant. I absolutely loved it. It was really good. But people will be shocked to hear that I haven't been looking at Jaguars this week. I have, but I'm not going to declare it on the podcast. I tell you what I started looking at this week. Smart cars.
Oh, right.
It was prompted by the fact that I saw a slightly ratty Smart 4-4. Don't see them around. And then it just basically got me into the whole smart story, which is so fascinating because I don't know if people realize it started in the world of Swatch watches. You know, those ones where you could interchange the
I had a Swatch watch. I bought it in Paris.
Brilliant.
They were all the rage in the 80s. And then the guy behind Swatch watches wanted to do a similar concept with a kind of city car where you could interchange panels and personalize it and all that kind of stuff. And then I think he did a deal with Volkswagen initially, but then they binned the collaboration and then he went cap in hand to Mercedes. And then a partnership with Mercedes was struck up as the micro car company. And smart is meant to be something like Swatch Mercedes art is what smart is meant to be for, apparently.
So would you have a 4-4? Would you have a 4-2 or quite what?
Well, I'd actually have a Roadster again because I owned a Roadster.
Yes.
Ruinously unreliable.
I was going to say, didn't this Roadster like ruin you financially?
I lost thousands in depreciation, but let's put that to one side. Your brain forgets about all that and you can now still buy them for a few thousand and I think I'd absolutely have one. But I've got to say, when I was looking around for them, I saw a Gen 1 4-2 because they were introduced in 1998, but they weren't officially in the UK until about 2001. So you can get pre-01 cars, but they'll have been imported prior to the dealer network taking them on. But I found a fairly late 4-2, 2004, I think it was, 4-2 Cabrio, which was only a couple of grand. and it was a passion spec one, so that's a high spec one. I just thought, oh, do you know what? Maybe that's okay. Maybe that's where to go. Roof, a bit of open top motoring. I could park it up near the bins. It'd be quite compact, you know. I could just squeeze it in. I think
presumably
that would be
this is about your driveway layout, not because.
Yeah, I'm just trying to justify why I can squeeze yet another car on the driveway when I've already run out of space. But there's a book about the history of the smart car, and it's a brilliant sort of cautionary tale of how difficult it is to A, launch a car brand, and then B, make it work. Because I think Mercedes lost 4 billion euros or something in a very short space of time. So if you want to set fire to lots of money, start a car company seems to be the lesson.
So if you do end up buying one, you clearly lay your history on them.
Yes, exactly. And yet, despite me owning them and it being generally a disastrous time reliability-wise, I still wanted to buy one. But anyway, there we go.
There's no help in some people, is there?
I think it's probably time we wrap up, isn't it? But yes, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure as always.
Viewers and listeners, thank you very much for your time. If you haven't done so already, don't forget to like and subscribe if you're watching this on YouTube, or give it a quick follow or even a comment on the podcast platform of your choice. We'll be back next week for another rendition of the Classics World podcast. In the meantime, thanks for all your time, and we'll see you again soon.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.